Well, I'm here in the studio at KLCC today with Tiffany and George. And my name is Carolyn Garcia. And we are old friends, George and I, from a long time ago. And actually, we're married at one point, as I recall.
I seem to recall that as well.
So we know each other pretty darn well.
And I'm George Walker. I was part of this Merry Prankster thing from day one. And I still am a part of this Merry Prankster thing. We've been doing this now for well over 50 years, and we hope to continue it for some time to come.
Do you remember when you met, where you were?
I do. I remember it was in Ken Kesey's yard, and Ken had invited me to a party that happened a couple of weeks after he invited me, and I came down there not knowing hardly anybody, having only met Neil and Ken up to that point. And there was George and Hassler and Dale and Mike Hagen. And that was my introduction to the prankster scene, was this really lovely party. And George was there.
Remember that, George?
Well, there were a lot of parties back in those days and a lot of people that showed up and were introduced. And I don't remember that exact event, but I do remember Mountain Girl, as we called her, and somebody said, well, why was she called Mountain Girl? And she's because she lived up there on the mountain. But, I remember her becoming a part of our scene, and I would say that was probably 1965.
Yes, it was, and it was the party that Ken had to introduce his friends to the first piece of film footage from the bus trip. And they had shot all this film on their famous magic trip. And Ken had gotten some of it developed and wanted to show it at this party. And as you remember, there was problems with the projector, but they did show some of it. And there was quite a few people there, many of whom I still know and love today.
Yeah, yeah. They projected on the wall, did
they? We hung a big sheet up in the redwood trees and... it was a wonderful group of people, and I have to say I met a lot of friends that day. I was a teenager in Palo Alto. I had lost my job, I had lost my boyfriend, and I was sitting in the coffee shop, and these two guys came up to me and said, hey, girlfriend, hey, girl, what you doing? I'm like, nothing. And they said, hey, you want to go smoke a joint? You know, and this is 1965, so that was like really undercover activity, right? But it just turned out that I happened to have also had a joint in my pocket, and I said, sure. And so they took me for a ride over to a little park, and it was Neil Cassady and his sidekick. And they took me up to Kesey's many hours later, and I saw the bus, and I met Ken, who was still up and at 4 in the morning, and everything kind of went from there. Changed my life.
No kidding. George, did you, around that time, were you already friends with Ken?
Oh, yes. I had met Ken in about 1960. He had already graduated and left the University of Oregon at that time, and I was still a student there. I had one more year to finish. I had become close friends with Mike Hagen a couple of years earlier. And Hagen and Kesey were very close and were fraternity brothers at Oregon. So knowing Hagen, he was always talking about Kesey. Ken by then, even before then, had gained a lot of notoriety, fame, or depending on who you were, notoriety or fame. But he was a known character, and so he was somebody you heard about. Mm-hmm. Around campus, even though he had already left. He was at Stanford at this time in the creative writing program, where he wrote One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and became world famous rather than just around campus famous. But Hagen was always talking about him, and, oh, Kesey did this and Kesey did that, and it was all very exciting sounding stuff. And so then in summer, I believe, of about 1960, Hagen said, well, Kesey's coming. We'll get together and we'll do a bunch of stuff. And sure enough, Kesey came and we did a bunch of stuff and ran around and had fun. And I said, wow, what an amazing guy. And we've been friends ever since. But also Ken had already begun these experiments at the hospital, the mental hospital in Menlo Park, the government place that was doing the MK Ultra program, experimenting with psychedelic drugs. And Kesey having also a job as a night watchman or something, I don't know quite what he did, an orderly at the hospital, had access and keys, and including a key to the door and the drawer where said psychedelics were stored. And somehow it seemed like there was quite a lot of disappearance of those things, and so we began experimenting with those things, and that was some of the stuff that we were doing.
Do you think he thought of that door as the one to enlightenment?
Yeah, definitely. This was one of the doors of perception. There's no question about it. This whole thing has always, in my mind, been about consciousness, levels of consciousness, raising our consciousness, expanding, seeing things in different ways, whether it was various mind games that we played, taking drugs, filming, recording ourselves and listening and playing it back and looking at film and stuff. It was all about becoming more aware of our subconscious in ways that we could become different from ordinary, mundane human beings.
When was the first time you ever heard the words put together, acid test?
Something passing the acid test, because it was already a known term, that's why Kesey used it. He didn't really make up the term. He put it to a different meaning.
In chemistry, it's a certain thing that you do to figure out what kind of metal might be in an object. And so there's an acid test for gold and an acid test for silver.
Particularly about gold.
And I think that's what we were quoting from.
And then it also became more a part of the language just to mean if something was passed muster. Uh-huh. It passed the acid
test. Inspection.
Yeah. It became to mean more than just in chemical terms. It became more in general usage as something that would pass muster. So we knew the term. And when Kesey came up with the idea of using it as we used it for these events that we did, it made perfect sense.
Wait a minute, George. Pass muster is such a strange term because it's about the Army. It's about going into the Army and having to pass tests, physical tests.
That's true.
To get into the Army. So I want to drop that one. That's just, we're going to have to just move past that thought.
Away from
because
the military.
Because we weren't going into the Army.
I'm all about
it. We were being tested for our purity of purpose and soul. You know, how strong is your soul? How pure is your purpose? And I think that's what acid test was kind of about.
And do you know, because I'm not quite certain now, if LSD was ever called anything, was called acid before this?
Yes, it was.
It was.
That was why he chose the term, because it had this
double meaning.
That was the chemical term.
Name, dextrolysergic acid diethylamide 25, lysergic acid. It's basically a lysergic acid compound, of which there are many. And most of them are psychedelic. And so the street term for LSD became acid. Mm-hmm. So everybody was talking about taking acid before this, before we used the term the acid test. And that was why Kesey used that term, because it had this double meaning. Passing the acid test, meaning, you know, you passed. You had achieved some kind of goal. And at the same time, it had the meaning of taking acid, taking LSD. So it had this double meaning. And Kesey was great at picking up on things like that. So, you know, he coined the term the acid test for these parties that we had where, at the time, it was still legal. So we handed out LSD to people that came.
Were you both at the first, or did
yes.
you attend together?
I was.
I did not. I had gone home for Thanksgiving, as it turns out, to see my mother and missed. But while I was home for Thanksgiving to see my mother, I snuck in a visit to Millbrook because there was this big scene going on at Millbrook. I grew up in upstate New York, and Millbrook was just a hop, skip, and a jump from where my parents lived. And so I borrowed my mom's car and went right over there. I think it was the day after Thanksgiving. And they had run into some trouble with the law there. And Timothy Leary needed a ride into town to go to the bank. And so I, in my mom's old car, we had Timmy covered up with a blanket, and I drove him to the bank and back, and that's how I got to know them.
For those
I was the volunteer that just happened to come to the door.
Wow. For those who don't know, Millbrook was the place where Tim Leary and Dick Alpert sort of centered their activities that were somewhat parallel to ours. They were doing research on psychedelic
drugs. Yes, they certainly were. They were doing all kinds of cool research.
They lived there and carried on there.
What made the parties different from, hooking up with friends and dropping?
Well, they were planned, and plus we always set up we always tried to have it in a place where we could have a perimeter. So, walls in an area where we would have a front door, in other words, that was defended, just to make sure that it was safe on the inside. And so people felt free to behave as they wished. And we set up all sorts of little gadgets and fun things. We had hand instruments out. There was usually the band would come and play. And we had paints and strobe light and Mylar to make play with when you're high. All this stuff, these were new toys. What LSD makes you want to play around with stuff like that. Although it was kind of limited because we always had to clean up afterwards.
The band, as Mountain Girl Carolyn refers to, was the Grateful Dead. Mm-hmm. And yep. The fact that we had a band and that they played music that was, because they took LSD too, the fact that the music was affected by the acid and was different from what people had been listening to, that was a lot of what made it different. Because a lot of times, we would get together, a number of people would get together and get high, take LSD or other psychedelics, or just smoke weed or whatever, and it would be like a party. But this had this additional element that, in addition to being a party, there was this featured band that was different, and everybody was really getting into that, and it kind of changed what the culture was about. Before that time, there were concerts, there was music, people went to concerts, but they were just people sitting in the audience.
Yeah, you had to sit
band.
At concerts
yeah.
until what?
And occasionally,
very late
there were
60s.
There were also dances where people danced, mm-hmm. but most of the dances at that time, they were more like ballroom dancing. Rock and roll dancing was kind of an outcropping from these events. So the way that this was organized was really different from anything that had been done.
Yeah. Members of the band, they were jamming. I can see it in my mind's eye. And also probably there was probably not a really strict line between the band and the party goers.
No, the stage was 2 inches high. This was the early days. Nobody knew who those guys were, and nobody cared. And we hadn't gotten to that place yet. But meanwhile, they were practicing playing in chaotic environments. And what they said was, oh, yeah, we love the chaos. That's really fun for us. We're used to playing in bars where nothing ever happens. So this was great for them because they could just be playing the music they wanted to play. It didn't matter. And they could work on stuff, but they could also get high with everybody else. And often they just would sit down in the middle of a set and stare at the floor for a little while. So they were definitely more than just the show. They were part and parcel of the event, and it was really hard to do anything without them. It was too quiet. And we had a prankster band as well that would come on during the breaks. And that was sort of like we torture your ears now for 45 minutes. Ha,
we were quite probably the worst band in the history of music.
George, you were a part of the band.
Yes, I was the drummer. I often brag that I played drums badly in the worst band in the history of the world. But
it was pretty bad.
The thing that you point out, that the erasure of the line between performer and audience, was one of Ken's primary goals in mm-hmm. doing this. He had seen that there was audience and performer, and that there was a line between them, and he wanted to get rid of that. He wanted everybody to be partaking in some way. He wanted these to be participation events rather than just go and be entertained. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the main goals. And I think that that's something that has survived even to this day, that we're still trying to do that. We're still trying to make our events into something where you come and in some way you participate. You don't just sit there in the audience and let it wash over you and be entertained. Ken really wanted to include people, and so it was a very inclusive kind of event. And this was different, too, because this apparently hadn't been done, at least our knowledge.
Well, it hadn't been done, especially with microphones and speakers, which really sort of changes the size of the voice. You know, you can have this really big, booming voice from a little microphone, or you can change it up and turn it into a tape delay or a big echoey thing, or you know that we played with a lot of that stuff. And so Ken had invented this thing, a very cool thing called the Ascot Ball, probably after the acid test, but eventually he arrived at this thing, and it was like a Nerf basketball with a microphone stuck in, a wireless mic stuck in it, and he would just pass it around to people and they could talk into it and it would come out over the speakers, and it worked really well. It was very entertaining. And but he like George says, he firmly believed in engaging the people that come to the thing, engaging them and having them become part of the show or part of the event itself, so that if anything happens, you know, we've got everybody's attention. Nobody's dreaming. It's kind of a wonderful thing.
Right. A recording in time.
Mm-hmm. We had been doing this, some of these participation things in small parties at Ken's for some time before we started doing the acid tests. He would play a game of spin the bottle. We'd sit around in a circle and we'd have something that we'd spin around like a bottle or something, and it would point at somebody. And there were a couple of different versions of this. One of them he called the attention game. So whoever the bottle pointed at, everybody had to give them their full undivided attention for some prescribed amount of time. And another one he called the power game, and this one was really scary because whoever was the designated winner or loser of the power game, they were the absolute dictator of everybody for some amount of time, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, half an hour, something like that. And so they could take everybody that was there and they would be the ruler, and everybody would, in theory, mm-hmm. obey this person's orders. And so these were all things that were leading up to this, where Ken was constantly experimenting with ways to get people involved, get mm-hmm. people's consciousness into different areas where they would at first be probably uncomfortable doing it, but in the process we would learn. This was very much a learning experience. Being around Kesey was like going to no school you ever saw, but it was very much a learning experience, and we were training ourselves to do these kinds of things that we've continued to do.
The power game was tricky because because not only do you have the power, but everybody's looking at you for their orders. And so you got to come up with something. I found it very difficult. It pushes a lot of buttons about being nice, you know. Oh, wait a minute, I need to be nice here. You know, let's all go make sandwiches. You know,
something
completely, you know, and nobody really wanted to have everybody go take their clothes off and jump into the freezing creek. You know, it didn't, or, you know, we were, it pushes your paranoia buttons about what's appropriate. So for me, it was a really tricky one.
Oh, me too.
I had trouble with it.
It was scary. I did too. But in the process,
we're too nice. You know.
In the process, we learned a lot.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You learn about yourself. You know, you learn. It's a courage test, really, because it really puts you on the spot.
Sounded like Kesey's intention.
Well, and I think he was a great fan of Fritz Perls, the Gestalt instructor that lived in a cave in Big Sur. And I think some of these games came from Fritz Perls. I suspect that they came from the Gestalt psychology community, that they sound like that kind of, but I didn't know anything about that stuff then.
That's true. So, if not the games in themselves, at least the thought behind them, the idea of putting people into these
situations,
which were not always comfortable situations.
No.
There was tension involved in it, but hopefully it was good intention. That
it seemed to be.
It always seemed to be, yeah.
Well, you're describing what was an uncomfortable and you know, a tricky game, a part of the experience. Were all the experiences, I mean, in addition to this power game where it's uncomfortable, I mean, you know, were there bad trips? Were there bad moments? Were there fearful moments? Or
we were pretty welded, you know, but we didn't really have that many bad moments until the law came in. You know, the law has a way of creating bad moments out of a really good party.
Yeah, so. There will be a culmination, an end, and I believe it was the graduation. Was that the last acid test in 66?
Technically, the graduation was not really an acid test. It was a move beyond the acid test. The last acid test was in the spring of 66. And the graduation was Halloween of 66. Mm-hmm. And we stopped doing acid tests as such when it became illegal. By the time we got to the graduation, we were not giving away LSD because it had been outlawed.
Well, and everybody had some anyway.
And everybody had some anyway.
You didn't have to.
Yeah, of course. But we were no longer doing it like we had done before, where we would just hand it out to everybody and people come in and I'd hand them a hit of acid and they'd take it. And we did not do that at the acid test. So it was technically, the last acid test was before we went to Mexico and this was after we came back. So strictly speaking, the acid test graduation was not an acid test. It was like the next thing, the door to the next thing where we were going to move on and do other stuff.
Commence.
And several things happened on the way to that graduation. One of them was Bill Graham and the contract that he had with the Grateful Dead. We somehow, Ken got the impression that the Grateful Dead were going to come and play as always at his event, but Bill Graham sneaked around and got them to promise, was going to pay them to play at the Fillmore. And when there was a lot of little under the table kicking and complaining and, you know, trying to renegotiate and all that stuff, and none of it worked out. And at the last minute, the band made up their mind that they were going to go pay a playing gig for Bill Graham and avoid the Keezy mania. And so that was a blow. And so that meant an awful lot because we'd advertised it heavily. And a lot of people were going to come, and they wound up not coming. So we were under-attended. And the acid test graduation, we didn't get a crowd. We got a lot of people, but it was not a crowd.
George, were you there?
Oh, yes. I was at every event. I went to every acid test and the graduation.
And got your diploma?
Got my diploma. I cut it up in little pieces and turned it into artwork.
I'd like to see that.
Uh-huh. And it probably doesn't exist anymore.
Mountain Girl, you also got your diploma.
Yes, I did. No, I was there. And yeah, I only missed one acid test. That was the first one.
When you were with your mom.
Yeah. So that was a big event. You know, by this time I had a 6-month-old baby, and things were different. We were in this ghastly warehouse in San Francisco, a place that we had been for a couple of weeks getting ready for this thing. But I had been busy sewing all the outfits that everybody wore, these beautiful white coveralls that were from a workman's store down on Market Street somewhere, and they were called, the label inside these things said, Union Made, Can't Bust Them. And every button on them said, Can't Bust Them. Because by this time, we'd been busted enough, you know. We didn't want any more. So I found these coveralls. They were great, and I got some for everybody. And then I sewed big blue pieces from the flag store onto the back and onto the front, so they had American flag stuff on them. They were very striking, and they were all the same. We're sort of like the space program, I thought. You know, it's a little bit like astronauts in these outfits. And they were gorgeous. That was sort of one of my big contributions to it. And then at the same time, as we're doing all getting ready for this stuff, you know, we've just come back from Mexico. Nobody has any money. We're just barely getting by. And hoping for some money from the event.
I was definitely ill.
And that's when Tom Wolfe showed up to do these interviews. And so the way he conducted interviews with individual pranksters was he'd take them out to lunch.
Wow.
Oh, it worked.
Oh, yeah.
Food.
Plied people with food.
We're hungry.
Plied hungry pranksters with food and got a book out of it.
Yes.
Good work, Tom.
Yes.
I want to make sure and get this question in because I've thought about it a lot. Trying to envision the scene, what the group looked like. Was there a lot of diversity amongst you?
We all designed our own costumes independently. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we'd go to the fabric store and find something, oh, that's far out looking, and we'd turn it into a shirt or a pair of pants or a jacket or a vest or something. Mm-hmm. And everybody had their own fantasy of what you might look like. And so there was a vast diversity of costumes. I remember one time Paul Foster showed up, and he had completely taped himself up with like medical adhesive tape. He was completely covered with tape. And he had a sign on him that said, you're in the Pepsi generation, which was their phrase there at the time.
And I'm a pimply freak.
He says, you're the Pepsi generation.
And you couldn't see him at all. He was completely covered with silver duct tape all over.
Was it silver? I was thinking it was white medical tape.
Maybe it was.
But he was all taped up, and he had this sign just hung on him. You're in the Pepsi generation, and I'm a pimply freak.
I think he had crutches.
And he looked like a mummy.
Yeah.
And Paige Browning painted one side of his face black and the other side silver or gold or white or something. And he was like right down the middle, one side dark and the other side light.
I thought that was great.
And I had this fluorescent pink fur vest that I wore. And, you know, and on and on, all these wild, crazy costumes that we wore. Mm-hmm. Kesey showed up at the one at the Longshoremen's Hall in a space suit with a helmet on so you couldn't see who he was because he had just gotten busted and was running from the police as often he was. So, yeah, there was a huge diversity among us, the way we were all dressed.
And in terms of the female perspective, if you could, you know, did you feel like one of the guys or one of the group, or was there anything different about it as a woman?
Well, I had the sewing machine, for starters, and my friend and Gretchen as well. And she had, all the way through the acid test, had sewed beautiful shirts for people. They actually set up a shirt-making factory that made shirts all different wild colors and that were made, built to last. They were really good shirts. And I sewed the spacesuit for Ken, and so I did a lot of whatever hadn't been covered yet, and doing those, getting those coveralls done took me a week. I mean, I had to walk everywhere to get stuff. You know what I mean? It was just like, you know, maybe I'd get another $20 and I could go get two more. You know, that was that type of a deal where we're just kind of scrambling all the time to come up with something new and different that would hold together for enough that we could wear it more than once.
Yeah.
That was kind of key for me. I got tired of everything falling apart by the end of the night.
Incidentally, I have fairly recently discovered and recovered my original acid test costume pants.
Oh, excellent.
And I will probably wear them at least some of the time during this upcoming event on Friday.
Wow.
Red and blue stripes, right?
Not exactly. They were dark blue corduroy pants, and they had long, lengthwise, horizontal, vertical stripes sewn on them that were like 2 inches wide, and they were like fluorescent, Day-Glo-colored satin material sewn on, like ribbon.
That's
so they've got like pink and green or orange and green stripes.
Yeah, it was.
They're a little bit tattered, but I can still squeeze into them, so I intend to at least wear them some of the time this coming event on Friday.
Way to go, George. I mean, 50 years later, you can get in them. Mm-hmm. You two, you married.
We did.
Eventually, yeah.
The day before Sunshine was born, if I recall.
That's right. We had to get married. It was like a week before. We were in Mexico.
Was it a week? Gosh, I thought it was just a
less
day or
about 2 weeks, I think.
Oh, it wasn't that long.
Yeah, it was.
Really?
Anyway, the deal was the Mexican attorney had told us that we would have trouble getting a birth certificate for my baby that was coming if I wasn't married, because in Mexico they very much frowned on single women giving birth, and that was just it was, make it make it was, really complicate
it
the
was
issue.
Illegitimate.
It was going to make things difficult. So we decided to do a quickie prankster wedding. And George said, "Well, I'll marry you." and so he did.
So I did.
and we drove the bus down to the city hall in this little Mexican town. And the mayor came out and married us and signed the marriage certificate with one of those crazy signatures, you know, that goes all over the page. Nobody can ever read.
Manzanillo, Mexico,
yeah.
On the coast.
And Sunshine was born
shortly thereafter.
Very shortly
in
thereafter.
Mexico.
Uh-huh.
And Sunshine's dad mm-hmm. is Ken Kesey. Did you stay married and just kind of go along? How'd that work out?
It's kind of like having a driver's license. It's not something that you worry about too much. I think we were married till about 1980.
Yeah, it was 80 or 81, something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, he went to Hawaii. I mean, we never saw each other.
Yeah, we never really lived together.
We didn't cohabit at all.
No, we weren't husband and wife.
We
were technically married, but we didn't live as
piece
married people.
Piece of paper.
We just remained really good friends.
Indeed.
And still do.
Yeah, and still to this day.
Well, we all understand each other, and we've lost so many members of our group. It's really tough. Sometimes you think about them, you know, we're going to have to honor them some way at our event coming up here.
In a way, being really married was kind of an insurance policy because nobody could come and say, okay, now you got to marry me. Why can't? I'm already married.
Right. Yeah. But it did happen for you, Carolyn, that you did remarry. You didn't marry Ken Kesey.
No. Well, he was thoroughly married way before all this.
Yeah.
But no, Jerry and I got married in 1981.
Yeah, I remember...
Finally.
As I remember it, Carolyn...
We've been together for almost 15 years.
Had two kids.
That time.
Carolyn finally came to me and said, we've got to get divorced so I can marry Jerry. Mm-hmm. I said, fine. Show me the papers. I'll sign. Not a problem.
No,
there was never any issues.
I think it cost
it.
$20.
There was never any issues between us about any of that. It was we both totally understood what the situation was, and we're both totally, as far as I can tell, I was always totally comfortable with it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Did you ever remarry, George?
Did I ever? I don't think so.
He takes all this stuff so seriously.
Not that I can remember.
And was there a real reason why you married Jerry Garcia?
Yeah, we'd been together for a long time.
So it was time.
They had kids.
We had two kids. It was just time.
It was time to be married.
It was time to be married.
You know, for the sake of the kids and stuff was the way it seemed.
Yeah.
It seemed like
yeah.
a great idea to me, and we remained friends, and I mm-hmm. remained friends with Jerry, and sometimes even stayed with them for a day or two at a time, or a week at a time.
Even borrowed money from us at one point.
Paid it back with interest.
Yeah, you sure did.
And just to run down, so Carolyn, you have three children,
mm-hmm.
and how old are they?
50. This is the scary part. 50!
Sunshine's 50?
Yeah, and Annabelle is 45, I think, and then the youngest is 41 or 2.
Yeah.
It's a lot of years have gone by since all that fun was had.
It is so true. Yeah. And being 50, I'm 50 mm-hmm. this year. Mm-hmm. Steve's 50. And
yeah.
Sunshine's
Ooh, that's a
50.
Big year for 50.
So was 66 was a good year
mm-hmm.
for baby bearing. Let us get to... what this reunion, this commemoration upcoming this Friday means to you. I mean, this is kind of an epic reunion.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned how many pranksters aren't here anymore.
That's right.
We talk of Ken Kesey, mm-hmm. Whom
What's
we lost.
What's even more interesting to
Jerry.
Me is how many are here and are going to be here. It's the 50th anniversary of this acid test graduation that we've spoken about a little while ago. And the actual anniversary is Halloween, which is Monday. And we thought, well, on the weekend's better, so we'll have the event on the Friday. A hall is available. But it's the 50th anniversary of the acid test graduation. I'm personally going to deliver the unofficial, official commencement address. And people have asked me, what are we graduating from? And I said, No. We're not graduating from.
To.
It's a commencement, right. A beginning.
Right.
We are graduating to the next thing, whatever that is. And I'll be talking about that probably at greater length than most people are comfortable with on Friday night. People will get bored and start saying, enough, get back to the music and stuff like that. But I'm going to deal with this and try to explain what my take on that is and what this means, because now half a century has passed and we will look to see, you know, what has happened and where can it go from here. And I think there's a lot to be said about where it can go from here. I think that we had a commencement in 1966, and now 50 years later, we can reflect on that and we can continue that moving forward, that beginning. There's always a fresh beginning. But it's still about the same thing. It's still about consciousness, about people raising consciousness, people being aware of stuff in different ways. And it's about positive thinking. It's about love and enthusiasm. It's not about hate and fear. We're trying to be on the side of good vibes, good feelings, loving one another, and being fair and right with each other, rather than all the separation that's happening in our world today. So we need to, I think, renew these ideas from time to time. And I think that we're now at a time that there's a possibility of a resurgence in the kind of consciousness that began in the 60s. And so I think that we're seeing now is a really an appropriate time to reiterate what it is that we're about and to renew our commitment to these ideas.
It sounds like it's a sort of a keeping hope alive.
I'm very optimistic about the future of consciousness.
Well, I think that's also what the pranksters were about was really an issue of collaboration. And so by collaborating,
yes,
on this event, the circle of collaboration can spiral outward year after year. People who met each other and engaged with each other perhaps at one small event, and then that goes out. That collaboration keeps growing, and so the circle gets a little larger all the time. It's like a spiral growing. And, you know, we've seen that plainly over the years. It's kind of hard to envision how many people the acid tests have actually touched. And then when Tom Wolfe's book came out, which is just like suddenly it became this huge American event, and that's luckily sort of died away. But we feel it's time to just honor what we used to do, and let's do some more of that. And pass it on to this next bunch of people that may not have been able to participate in that way back in the 60s, and just coming up with great, great zany ideas and finding friends and go do it. And then bring that energy back in to sort of illuminate the core principles of collaboration and getting along with each other and having a great time doing it.
We hear sometimes that things skip a generation. Have your children embraced these concepts, Carolyn?
Sort of. I mean, I would have to say they would rather go to Burning Man and wander around in the desert, you know. But they do. You know, but everybody has a different artistic lookout in my daughters. They're all artists. Some like, you know, one of them likes to work by herself. The other one wants to work with people, you know. So it's different for each person.
Yeah.
And it isn't for everybody.
But that's cool.
But they understand it because they grew up with it. So it feels very comfortable to them. And for them to go and look at pictures of themselves with all the other kids of this group, which was quite a few, and we're all friends still. We just don't see each other often enough, and that's why it's important to get the attention of everybody and get them to come to this.
Well, that's another thing, is that this event is bringing a lot of people out of the woodwork, a lot of our old prankster mm-hmm. friends. This will probably be the biggest gathering of original Merry Prankster participants in many, many years, and probably the biggest that there ever will ever be. I don't think that this many of us will gather together again, probably ever. So it's really kind of an epic thing for us, just, you know, personally, to see all of us together again to do this one event. So it's really special for us to see it in that way. It's very reminiscent. It's, you know, these anniversary things become meaningful as you get older.
Yes.
And we definitely have gotten older.
We've gotten a little older, but we're still goofy, and we still bring our bubbles to these things, you know, and dress up and just have a good time and prank a few people and try to get along with the folks that own the place as best we can.
I went on
not
tour
leave
this.
Too much of a mess.
I went on tour this summer with a film called Going Further. That's about a trip Zane took. On the 50th anniversary of our bus trip, and he took the new Further bus on a tour of the country, going to festivals all over the place in the East Coast. He went all the way to New England with it, and it was filmed, and a film, a very good film, has been made of this, which may or may not be showing this weekend in town. But at some point it will, if it doesn't happen now. Yeah. And I toured with this film this summer and did question and answer sessions with crowds and met and talked with people and saw a lot of these festivals that are going on. And it was very enlightening and very empowering to me. I was treated extremely well. People relate to what we did. And it's also made me realize that there's a lot of activity going on that is reflective of what it was that we began 50 years ago. And there are a lot more people than I had any idea. Young people, and they're, by young people, to me, young people is anybody that's not on Social Security. And they are of those ages, everywhere from kids, and even little kids, to people in their 60s and even 70s that are going to festivals all over the country, and they're celebrating this level of consciousness. And a thing I see that's really different and very encouraging is that these people are mostly responsible people. In the 60s, there were hordes of these hippie kids that showed up in San Francisco, flower children, teenagers that had just left home with practically nothing. And it kind of came down to nothing because they had no way to sustain themselves. They weren't prepared to live in the actual world. They were just out on a lark. And when winter came and it was cold and they didn't have places to live and they didn't have food to eat and they didn't have money and jobs and any of the sustaining things. And so it was kind of doomed to fall apart. But now people have homes, they have businesses or jobs, they have families, they have responsibilities, and they live up to these responsibilities. And then they go off for, depending on how good their business is, a day or a weekend or a week or a month, and they go and they celebrate. They have these parties, these various kinds of festivals, music, art, barter fairs, gatherings of all descriptions and all sizes, all over the country, all summer, every weekend, they're happening everywhere. And I was kind of astounded to discover how much is going on, how much energy there is, and how positive the energy is. I didn't see a single act of violence all summer. I didn't hear of anybody getting ripped off. I think one person lost a camera all summer that I knew about. But there, it was so much positive feeling, so much good vibes, and it made me realize, you know, this time, maybe this can get over the top. I draw an analogy to surfing because Kesey talked about it as a wave. He said, we didn't start this. All we did is we saw this wave of energy and we surfed the wave. And talking to surfers, I lived with surfers when I had a boat in Hawaii. And I learned about waves. They come in sets, and there's big waves and small waves, and there's big sets and little sets. And the 60s was a huge wave and a huge set. Thanks. And what we see now is another huge set that's happening. And there are huge waves happening. And as I say to people, it's incumbent upon you now to catch this wave, to surf this wave, because if we all do this, I think we can now surf it all the way to the beach. We can finally land this thing on solid ground. And I think that we can be a force to be reckoned with if we can get everybody together and thinking together and working together. And that's what I'm about now.
Nice. Let's wrap this up with a... I'd like to ask both of you to illuminate me. You just gave a pretty cool metaphor. What would you choose to be the metaphor for passing the acid test today?
Passing the acid test today.
So instead of saying maybe, can you pass the acid test? What would you pass the torch? Would you?
Well,
what are you thinking?
One of the things that Kesey said as we were preparing to do the graduation 50 years ago says the question is no longer, can you pass the acid test? The question is, did you pass the acid test? And if you did, you get a diploma. It has to do with arriving at a state of consciousness where you are comfortable with this higher level of consciousness. You're comfortable with alternative ways of seeing stuff from just what society prescribes for you. And so for me, personally, passing the acid test means that you are no longer captured by society. You can become a productive member of society, but not have your life dictated to you, that you can live life on your own terms.
Yeah, it's a type of boundary, but it's a boundary that's so plastic and flexible that you learn to recognize other people who have really stepped outside of the issues that we had in the 60s, which was a lot of repression, you know, a lot of, you know, groupthink and, you know, very politically charged situations of one after the Kennedy assassination and the Vietnam War. And, you know, the list goes on of the stuff that was wrong. And we've gotten past a lot of that. But I think the core concept of, you know, happy, friendly collaboration is still at the core. And so we're really graduating into another class of collaborators. Come on in, you know. We'll show you what we did. You can make up your own stew of interesting ideas and collaborate on that. And that's where we really encourage that.
It requires a commitment to positive thinking, mm-hmm. To love and hope, as opposed to hate and fear. Right after the first of the current debacle of presidential debates.
Oh, God.
I was watching one of the commentator shows, and I think it was Rachel Maddow, who said, well, it's pretty clear this election is between love and hate and fear. And we're about the love side of that. We're about the love and hope side of this rather than the hate and fear side of this. It's about having a good outlook on life, a good outlook on what's possible.
And it's a state of stability inside the self, too, that can both recognize situations and be of assistance. And, you know, we're sort of like,
yes,
we're sort of like spirit police in a kind of a way. You know, we've become sensitized to attitude and how people relate to each other. So we're just, you know, to build a better world, we have to get attuned to each other. And the attunement itself is a conscious process. And it's part of what the acid tests were about. We're attuning to each other and learning to be all in the same room together, no matter how big that room is. And so the Grateful Dead concerts went on and took that and ran with it. And after the acid test graduation, Ken had to go to jail. And that was kind of the end of the fun for us for a while. But he was only at the Sheriff's Honor Farm for 6 months. But basically, he took it very personally.
That was kind of humorous in a way, in an ironic way, because
really?
Part of the term, you know, he had to do a plea deal and agree to go to jail for a while. And part of his plea deal was that he had to be exiled from the county, from where he had lived in San Mateo County.
Where their home was,
where mm-hmm. he lived and where they had bought their home. And So he agreed to that and was going to leave. But then when they put him in jail, they very quickly took him to the sheriff's honor farm, which was literally in his backyard. I don't know if they actually had a common boundary, but it was very close. It was very, very close. His land kind of went up the hill, and at the top of the hill was where the sheriff's honor farm was. So they told him, you have to leave, and then they locked him up next door.
Wow.
And we always thought that was very ironic.
There's a lot of funny contributions from the sheriff's department during that period. They really didn't know what to do with us. They just didn't get it. And we had a lot of amusing tales to tell about the San Mateo County Sheriff's Department. But we won't go into that now.
Right.
That was so long ago. We're looking forward to this coming event very keenly, and we're going to be there early and stay late. So that's what we usually do.
I want to thank you both very much, George Walker and Carolyn Garcia, Mountain Girl. Thank you for coming in and talking about yesterday and today and tomorrow.
His prankster name is Hardly Visible, but we didn't use it that much because it was hard to say.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to come in and talk a little bit about this, because this is important to us. Mm-hmm. It's been my life. It's what I've done.
Thanks a lot, Tiffany. Nice
interview. Thank you, Tiffany.
Thank you
so much.